My name's Deborah, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Deborah.
And I want to thank this group for inviting me to come up and share. I did dress appropriately for the podium, which I was, you know, let known to make sure I did. And I'm also going to be sharing my experience, strength, and hope with you today, which will really give you all a big break, because I don't get to talk about my opinions. I don't, you know, really share that kind of stuff over about my story. I don't get into my drunkalog because you all have one, and that's really not, I mean, I needed to have that, but I also needed to move away from that. I also needed to never forget it. So I was actually reading part of Dr. Silkworth's story today, and I went to a study years ago about it, and I had lots of notes written on the sides and around it, and it said that Dr. Silkworth had 38 years of professional activity in that career, and that he had worked with over 40,000 alcoholics. And their recovery rate was 2%. So when he embraced the program, once he became aware of it and was asked to participate in it, he was amazed at how it worked. You know, it was one guy talking to another guy, you know, and that it was absolutely imperative that they have a spiritual experience, that they couldn't do it alone. So I think that, you know, if you can read those books, and that is our basic text, if you can, I did find myself in that story, and I've launched a long time of living sober because of that, and the people that were in my early times, why would I say that, right? those early days, and through the grace of God and this program, my dry date is April 27th, 1985. And so I moved to Rappahannock County in 1998 and began a journey, and I have been here longer sober than I was in California, where I came from. I had 14 years when I came here, and I think the first meeting I went to, I was kind of surly because my right arm was in a cast. Well, some things just don't change. I just had shoulder surgery a month ago, and I'm absolutely following directions. Go figure. I actually called people to get a ride, and I was contemplating not. I was going to drive myself. And talk about insanity, you know, we still have that moment of, I do, that I can get away with something, even if it's like small stuff. And so I was able to do that, and I just picked up my 34-year chip, and I have to smile at the fact that I still need to be around people who are keeping me honest, and they're all around me. I remember walking into a meeting that I was kind of cranky. I had an arm in a cast. It was 20 days or 40 days, or I was just moved here. And the first thing that they did at that group was say, you need to go into service, because I was new, I was cranky, I was in pain, and I didn't really like much of anything. So at that time, that group they started at 8:30. I mean, that's a late meeting anymore for me. And they would go and then break at 9:30 and have a cigarette break, and then they would come back. And sometimes they would go on till like 11 o'clock at night. And so when they said, you can run any way you want to, and I said, really? And they go, yeah. I go, I really can? They go, yeah. So I was in charge now, right? So at 9:30, I said, this meeting's over. And we closed the meeting. And half of the group went out and had a smoke break, And they all came back in and kept on going, even though I left, you know. And so that was a little bit of an eye-opener about how, you know, there's really no real gain in all that control stuff. And I might have had a little bit of issue with control when I came in here. So that meeting does close now at 9:30. I want to tell you that, but it's not because I said so. That's just probably what I think the message was. So I'm really grateful for that. I've been in service on and off in the area since I've moved here, and yet I've hardly ever been to any outside meetings. I have absolutely been living a wonderful life in sobriety, and my story started out a whole different way. I came to the night of my last drunk, being arrested. How rude, right? I was in the hospital, in the emergency room. We'd had a car accident, and I was being read my rights, and I felt offended. And the problem was the guy, the California State Trooper, that was standing there was the same one that I had scammed about 2 o'clock that afternoon, already in a blackout, and he was ticked off. And so the hospital felt sorry for me, so they invited me to stay, and I had some injuries, but they asked me if I would mind sharing a room with a smoker. And at that time, I was an avid non-smoker. I hated cigarette smoke. And so, but I was beginning to change already. I felt this feeling coming over me of generosity, and I said, sure, I'll share the room with a smoker. And the person that I shared the room with was one of the victims in my car accident, in the car with me, and she never did care to have a cigarette that week. Her injuries were far overwhelming, and it never occurred to her that she might like to have a cigarette. And the person that I was when I came in here, she got the window, and I don't know why they gave it to her. She couldn't even get out of the bed. So that's the person I was, and I remember being offended again, because the busyness would just, the doctors would come in, and they would zoom right past my bed, and they would tend to her needs. And I started getting an idea that perhaps I had a skewed perspective of how I ought to be. And I was in the hospital a week, and she was in for another week. And when they came back to my mother's home. My sister, myself, and I, we were it. Have you ever been it? It's totally a delusion. But we would run together, we drank together, we used together, we abused our family and our friends because we were in that hopeless state of mind and body. The week she came back, my sister and she both broke out the beer and other things, and I just had this awareness that I can't have a beer. And that truly was the first time in my entire life that I became aware that once I had the beer, it set up that phenomenon of craving. I didn't know about the phenomenon of craving. I wanted more. So I checked myself into a treatment center. The guy, I answered the phone, and he said his name was Angel. Now that had to be something. You know, I thought, wow, a guy named Angel wants me to come over. And he said, if you come tomorrow, we have a bed. If not, you're going to miss it for I don't know how long. So I went the next day, and my sister drove me, and she said, why are you doing this to yourself? And I really couldn't answer that, because I knew that the consequences to my car accident were mine. They weren't theirs. They were victims. Oh, what a place to be. I loved that role. But I knew then that it wasn't their time. So that began a long journey of a long period of dry time. I went into the treatment center. I was able to go to meetings. I couldn't match my shoes the whole time I was there. they looked right in one light and then they weren't. You know, I just was just, and if you've ever been in that early recovery stage where you probably think you have it going on, but you don't, it was so obvious to me that no matter how hard I tried, I was always messed up. So I remember going into, at that time, I was at the county hospital in Stockton, California, and they had a recovery treatment center there, which has sadly been closed for many years. The bus would take us around to different meetings, and we went into this meeting on Skid Row in Stockton, California, which is a rough place. And there was, like, all those, like, bum people. And they were very obviously leering, if you know what I mean. They were like, oh, yeah. And it ticked me off because, you know what, I was an opinionated girl. I had nothing in early sobriety except my opinions. And so I was able to share that with them, and I stood up in the meeting and I said, if this is recovery, I don't want any of it. And there was a man there, and I'll never forget him, never saw him again. He stood up, and it was a big meeting, and he said, "Gal, this isn't the recovery program." And he held the big book up, and he goes, "This, you know, demonstratively, is the recovery program." And it really set in my head that the fellowship is the fellowship, and a God loved this fellowship, and it's vital, I believe, for anybody to have a. For me to have a healthy, balanced life in recovery, but it is not the program. It is an element of the program and an attribute of the program, and it probably wouldn't be the same without it because of that one person working with another, and it happens a lot throughout the fellowship. So, fast forward, I was unemployable. And I had a lot of fines and penalties to pay, and so I went to work picking up the trash on the roads. I dusted the local museum. I don't know what. I went to work as a short order cook, volunteering. Yeah, right. Mandatory volunteering, court ordered. In this drop-in center on Skid Row. It seemed like everywhere I went, I ended up on Skid Row. And everywhere I had to go, it was in, you know, one of those low-life places. And so the man who was running it was a retired highway patrolman, and he kept me on long after the hours that I had fulfilled. And he would give me a little money to get gas, not that I had a car to drive because I wasn't allowed to drive for a year, plus 5 years of probation. So about 9 months later, my boss walked into that place, and I worked on a very exclusive, large, top, equine job, and I, you know, was it. I was it again, and I worked my way up to the top, and so I had all of that reputation, and all of that just went away that one night in that car wreck. And I wrote him a letter, and I said, you know, you remember that time that we were at the racetrack for the yearling sale, and you walked in at 10 o'clock in the morning, and I was laying hungover on a pile of filthy horse blankets in a filthy tack room in a filthy racetrack? Oh, yeah, they remember those times. And they really put up with a lot with me. And so I remember, I'm not going to go into those memories, but the point is I had let them down. I had really, really discouraged them. And here he comes after 9 months, and he looks around and he says, "What are you doing here?" And I said, "I belong here," because I had never asked him again for a job. I belonged here doing whatever. At this time, I figured God was now in charge because I had taken that third step almost immediately with going into the treatment center. You know, I learned about the steps there. And before I left, I had taken that first time third step, which was very powerful for me. And I began to work in that treatment center, you know, to get an A, because they scored how you made your bed. And I wanted that A. I wanted that sticky note on my door that said A. And something changed. You know, I started caring about doing a good job for the right reasons. So the man hired me back, and I worked for them. I pledged to myself that I would work for them as long as sober. I'd work for them sober as long as I worked for them drunk. Well, that means I'd already been there 7 or 8 years. It's like, oh, no. So I went to work there, and they said, you have no authority. You have no power. You have nothing but a job. And so I began doing that job, and 6 months out of the year, they put me on the folding crew. Well, I was the crew. There wasn't anybody else. So from 8 o'clock at night until 8 o'clock in the morning, I was a midwife for horses. It was wonderful. It was peaceful, and I would have to sterilize the stalls after the foalings, and I would put this little cassette speakers tapes, and I would listen to a lot of speaker tapes, and you know, time rolled on in that place. And at first there were some people that I had kind of stepped on the way up, if you know what I mean, and they were thrilled that I had no authority, and they gave me a hard time. But I knew that my higher power had me there for a reason, and that, you know, to become right-sized was just a good place to start, and that perhaps I had abused, you know, the power and been at least inconsiderate, if nothing else, to the people that were under me. So that was my early days. Those were my early days. And I worked for that person for another 7.5 years. And I began to realize with that much time that it was probably time to get married again. And I had been married before, and early when I was young, and it didn't last. It lasted about 2 years and a couple of days. And so I spent a short period of time before I remarried, and that lasted about 2 years and a couple of days. And so I didn't remarry until I had almost 8 years in the program. It lasted about 2 years and a couple of days. And so I thought, oh, I don't know how to do this, you know, not even in sobriety. And so for a very long period of time, that's the way it stayed, you know. I started going to local meetings, and when I got my car back, oh, my sponsor, she said, I met her in that drop-in center, and she said, you have to cook their eggs the way they want them. I said, I don't care how they want them. You know, there was no attitude problem here. And so, you know, she, you know, this is the way you can serve, you know. So I didn't care about serving. But I wanted to stay dry, sober. I didn't know there was a difference, but there was. And so I stayed with her for about 8 years, and she was my sponsor until I moved here. No, that was 14 years. And she hired me for a little while after I left the farm. I felt like I was no longer what I did. And I knew that I didn't want to grow old working on a horse farm. You know, I'd seen the ladies kind of cycle through all the farms and the big farms, and they were starting to look real tired and worn out, you know, and I thought, no, I better change profession. So the funny thing about that is now I'm growing old working on a cow farm. So, but like my husband says, but the difference is now you're in the big house, you know. Not that we have a big house, but my God has a sense of humor, you know, and he let me do that work. And at about 3 years sober, I went to my first women's meeting. When I was without a license my first year, my sponsor would not let me take rides from guys, because frankly, your guys are easy. They're real easy. And I would have to take rides from women. I would ask the women, like, ugh. And yet, that's the way it was with her, you know. She said, you're to fall in love with God. You're supposed to do service, and you'll have a better life. And so that's the way it went. And she worked me through the steps, and at 4.5 years sober, I had begun to sponsor a few women, and it seemed like I collected the oddest people. Fond memories, but nonetheless, I did the work. And at 4.5 years sober, I did the process of writing out the inventory, and I went through the fifth step with my sponsor, and then I did the process of the sixth and seventh steps and journeyed on to the remainder of the steps. I made amends where I could, wherever possible, not whenever and whoever, but wherever. And there's just, as you all know individually, there's so much story to that. Before, what it was like, what happened, that's what happened to me. And what it's like now is day and night. The difference is now I have a little bit of maturity. I've been married. I married again just before I moved here. The difference was he picked me. I didn't pick him. That was the biggie. And we just had our 24th anniversary. Not that we can ever remember, but we always seem to miss that date, you know. And but that is one of the gifts of this program, you know, because I know what not to do. You know, there's no burnouts, there's no vocabulary, there's none of that. You know, we actually talk about it. We really do share and talk about the things that rattle us. And he's a normie, which is probably really good because he's a very amazing man in so many ways. I think he's a genius. He has a photographic memory. He's just super talented. He makes our farm run because he's a mechanic. He's a master mechanic. He's just a great, great guy. And I don't get in the way of that, you know. And I told him early on, I said, you know, I don't know about this. I tell you, I'm kind of a loser at this. But one thing I will never compromise on, and that is my sobriety, the program, and the people in the program. They all come with me. This is a package deal. And he's seen the kind of people that want me to sponsor them. He's like, wow, how do you do that? And it's just a blessing, you know. I mean, they're just as crazy as a loon. And I could understand that. I really could, because alcohol takes so much away from us. You know, it strips us of any potential to be of any service to anybody. And I never knew I was an alcoholic. I never knew anybody that was an alcoholic. I had never heard the word, you're an alcoholic. And yet my mother, who, and you know, have you ever lived with your parents in adulthood? I used to do it all the time. And she would say to me, we would be getting ready to go out, you know. It's not like we could go out for dinner, no, because we had kids and we had to take care of them. And so as soon as they went to bed, and my mom would be the heavy staying at the house for us to dump the kids on her, then we would go out. And that's when stuff would happen, you know. And she said to me one day, do you know that you've been drunk for 4 days in a row? And I said, really? I never thought about it. But the people that are around us and the things that we do that hurt others behind all of that alcoholism, we get a chance to make up for that. We get that chance in this program. And what an opportunity it is. What a fabulous opportunity that my mom saw me leading step studies before she died, and that she was an alcoholic also, but she was a different kind of alcoholic than I was. She was reserved. She had the bottle of vodka underneath the counter in the kitchen, and you know, that was her deal. She got sober through an aversion program that was popular back in the day, where they would give you a shot of Anabuse, and then they would say, here, pick your favorite liquor and drink it straight, and then you couldn't have ice in your drinks, you couldn't have pretty glasses, and, you know, I mean, she got sober the hard way. And she came into the program because 5 years later after she got sober, because, you know, she needed that. She needed that. We took her there. That's what a hypocrite I was when I was drinking. And so she got to go through that process, and she loved the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. When she died, she had 28 years of clean and sober living and loved this program. She loved this program. So we would go through the, my sponsor wouldn't let me go to a discussion meeting until I had been that week. Now, every week you had to do this over and over. I had to go to a step study, a Bible study, a women's meeting, and then I could go to a discussion meeting. Because she knew that in the discussion meeting, I could spin off my attitudes and my opinions, and she didn't want that for me. She wanted the recovery. And so that's my story, and that's who I am today. You know, when I work with somebody, that's what they get to do, because that's my experience, strength, and hope. And I leave out the opinions about their checkbooks and their spousal problems and all of that. You know, it's really a relief not to have to have an opinion about something I don't really know anything about. So we're fast forwarding here, but I've now worked through the steps, and I have gone through basically all of them, but I say the 10th and 11th and 12th steps I worked when I was in California, when I had up to 14 years, I did those things. And I do believe that, you know, you hear a step a year. I think that you can go through them faster, but you can't live through them faster. It takes a long time for these things to become a part of me. So when I came here, like I said, I got launched into service very quickly, and within a year, because I also go to other places that talk about this higher power, and I knew I was searching for that. You know, it's like you go to a place where everybody knows your name, the old Cheers theme. I was looking and searching, and I was finding a lot of meetings and things that I liked going to, and I ended up sticking up mostly in Rappahannock County, and got involved here very early on. I've led many meetings. I mean, that's what I have to do. I just do that, and I live it, and I don't really think that it's a kudos for me, but it's my, I get to reap the benefits of it. You see, I have a very calm and stable life unless somebody gets in my way, and then I have to, you know, think about that. But for the most part, I got a new sponsor when I moved here, and I had watched her for a period of time until I realized that I wasn't going to be able to stick with that sponsor. You know, we had different lifestyles. I won't say any more about that. But that woman has remained a strong recovery person in my life, and I found another sponsor. And she's been my sponsor for all these years, and I recently felt that I had been sort of isolating in the last few years, you know, and I re-upped my time with her, and it felt really good. In the last few months, I've asked for people, well, not the last few months, but the last few weeks, I've had to ask for rides. And that room took me way back to the very beginning when I had to ask for rides. And so when I got onto my phone, you know, I thought, I got to call all these ladies. And I know them. And I, one boon, I called, and they never, none of them could do what I was asking them to do. And so I sat down and I talked to my husband. And I said, there's about three guys here that I think will do this, get me here tonight, you know. I said, how do you feel about that? And he goes, well, who is it? And the first one I said was, well, there's Patrick. Remember Patrick? And he goes, no. And I go, well, then there's Speedy. He goes, Speedy, I love Speedy. And then there was another guy, and he goes, oh, yeah, I know those guys. I said, well, are you okay with that? You know, I mean, today it matters what they think. And I give them I give people an opportunity to, you know, share what their opinion is instead of constantly forcing mine on you. I actually seek yours. So to me, that makes life a lot more interesting, because I know my stories. And so, you know, I don't know if there's ever a time that I'll say to myself, all right, I've done this long enough, because this is living to me. This is the practicing these principles in all our affairs, and without it, I'll get way out there way fast. And it doesn't matter if it's been 34 years since I've taken a drink. Now, because the ism, you know, I don't suffer from the alcohol today, but I occasionally have a little fallout with the ism. And I know what to do, and I know what not to do. But I can't isolate in that process. I have to share what's going on with me and let people, I wouldn't say minister to me, not out of this book, but it's the same thing. It's like walking alongside of you and saying, this is what I've done and this is how I've gotten through it, and you're going to be okay. And, you know, I don't have a lot of crises today. I think there's some in my future. Not that it's not life on life's terms, but it's looming out there. And I would never separate from the recovery process or the fellowship of this program in those times. So when everything is fine, I tend to be pretty content, and I'll slack off a little bit sometimes on my meetings, but that's never really a good place for me to stay. And it doesn't take long for me to realize that I'm missing so much by being around you. I miss out on all of those things that are going on in your life. And so that to me is very appealing, you know, to be a part of the mainstream, you know, pack it in, keep it close and keep it tight. And so, you know, I thought about it a lot today when I was actually knew that I was going to get to come here. And I thought how very long it had been since I had actually shared my story. And there's no way of really sharing it all. But the point is that, you know, that I'm still willing to do that. And there are so many things that happened, not so much in the Drunkalog stuff, because that's all really pretty tragic in spite of how funny we like to make it out to be. Today I have my son. I have one son, one and only, and he moved here kind of, you know, looking to save his marriage. And he had two little tiny kids, 1-year-old, 2-year-old, and they came out here about 12 years ago trying to make it happen, make it work for them. And there was an old house on the farm, and so they got to live in that old house, and she hated it because there were bugs in there. And, you know, she's from SoCal, you know, you can't fool those people, they know how to live. And so it didn't work, and so mom left, and the babies stayed, and I became mom. And so that kind of, I wasn't planning on that. That was not in my agenda. My husband and I have been living here for about 8 years, and we were totally happy, and now life changes, right? Okay, now we have little kids. And dad went to work as a deputy sheriff, and he was gone a lot. And so that's where we were. That was me and the two little girls and my husband. And all of a sudden, I had to put myself aside and do for them. And so we did that. And I'm very proud to say that, of course, I didn't do it alone. My husband is hugely involved in them, and my son. And they are now in, the oldest is 20, and she's in her second year at UVA. The other one is 19, and she'll be going into her second year at JMU. They won scholarships. I don't know where they got that. It wasn't from my side of the family, no. But they got an opportunity to have a stable life. Now, I never had that opportunity when I was growing up. We lived in a very weird household. I had a stepfather. He had a different idea about what a stepdaughter was to be to him. And he persecuted my sister and I for many years. And, you know, that's, I think, why I didn't take my fourth step for a long time in this program, because I thought that I had to forgive him. And it took me that long, 4.5 years, to just write it in the tiniest way, his name on that list. And what I learned was, it really wasn't about him. It was about letting God do what God does best, which is work through us. Whoa, you know, you mean it's not about me? And I lived in a lot of hate for a long, long time. And now I know what the sickness was. And I think it affected me, and I think it affected my mother, and I think it affected my sister. But I can tell you that about 9 years ago, when I did take that inventory, and I did say, yes, God, I am willing to do it however you see fit. Just open up and let you do whatever you can do. That it, the outcome doesn't have to, I don't have to even know what it is. I just have to be willing to do it. So those were kind of big steps. I don't know if people struggle over certain things in their past that they have to write on their fourth step. So, you know, I know today that I am not today or was ever a product of being a victim. I was really never a victim, although I may have been victimized. I chose to live in a great deal of hate and negativity, and I drank at it a lot. So once I realized that that was the exact nature of my wrong, it was a piece of cake, because I could let go of that responsibility of the outcome. So the kids are away, but they're home from college for the summer. They're working all the time. They're very ambitious kids, and they don't drink, they don't smoke. And, you know, I'm really happy for them. They have a lot healthier lifestyle start because of the foundation that we were able to give them through my recovery and my husband's just loyalty to the family, if you will, you know. And so about, well, over 9 years ago, I heard myself say on the phone to my sister, who had been a raging methamphetamine addict for years. And, you know, she and I had gotten sober. She had gone back out. She had gotten sober again. She'd gone back out. And I heard out of my mouth, and my husband was going, I said, are you ready to come here? And she said, yes. And she tells me to this day that what amazed her was that it was unconditional. I forgot to tell her she needed to get clean and sober, by the way. I just told her, are you ready to come here? Because I figured any time she's going to come here, she's going to know she's going to have to get clean and sober. But all she remembers is that I never put that condition on her. How did that happen? I'm a condition-putting person. And so, you know, and I really didn't want to complicate my life like that, you know. And today I can tell you, she came, hilarious stories, but she came here, and in December, she just picked up a 9-year chip. She picked up that 9-year chip, and she'll tell me today, I couldn't believe that you even asked me to come. So, you know, if you're willing and you let the concept work in your life that you're just a channel, that when you get an opportunity, you can lay yourself aside, however brief that may be, and see what God does. It's amazing. Wow. So those things have happened over and over and over in my life, you know. So I'm really happy about that. And I don't know what else to share with you guys, really. I know that it's not really important today, the end result for me, because I'm already hooked up, you know. I'm already hooked up with a higher power of my understanding. I've spent many years in this community now, and I I know a lot of people. It was funny because after a year here, going to all the churches and going to all the meetings, people would take us out to a restaurant after 1 year here. And people would stop by all the time at the table. Deborah, how are you doing? And they were like, how do you know all these people? And I said, well, I meet them in church, and I meet them here and there. I'm friendly, you know. And it's so far from the truth, you know. I'm here because I need to be here, and I'm also here because I want to be here. And that's the big difference. Somewhere in that, the first day and 2 day, that changed. And that'll change for you. And, you know, you just have to be willing to wait for it and do the next right thing. You know, we have a saying at our house that's, are you doing the right things or are you doing things right? Because I could be making the best cake in the world, but if I should be up in the office paying the bills, then I'm screwing up. And I don't need to put myself out there and set myself up for failure. I don't know if you guys have ever been afraid to go to the mailbox, but I remember when I got sober, there was a lot of stuff that came in the mail I didn't really care to see. So I didn't. And, you know, once I started working the steps and that second step started coming into play, you know, that I was becoming to get more sane, and I realized I didn't have to live in the fear and the projection, and I would go to the mailbox and I would open that stuff and I would actually look and see what the deadline was. And I would try to get that taken care of, you know. And what a feeling. I mean, it's a great feeling to be accountable and credible and reliable. And before I got sober, I was not, although I always did well at work. Did you guys always do well at work? Yeah, we like structure. We say we don't like it, but we perform well in structure. And this good, orderly direction that goes on in here, that's kind of it in a nutshell for me, because at work, I would thrive. And as soon as I got off on the clock with mine, not so much. And so I've learned that. You know, I had one more horse that had survived the fray of me coming out of the thoroughbred industry those years. And this is even in sobriety. And I was playing the unemployment game. You know how to play that game? You know how to play that game. You know, you call these people up and say, you're not hiring anybody, are you? No. Okay. And you put that down as a job search. Right. And so I was playing that game, and I wanted to be on my own, although that wasn't a healthy want at all. I had kind of already forgotten that. You know, remember, you don't do so well without the structure. So I had this one yearling, and I had a partner on it, and my girlfriend and I, we went up to the San Francisco, and we participated in a yearling sale. And I had this idea that I wanted $8,000 for the horse, and this man came up and he offered me $7,500 for it. And I said, no. Well, this was, I don't know how sober I was, but it was like 8 or 9 years sober. And that horse sold in the auction ring for half of that. And the guy walked up to me and laughed in my face. And he jerked the lead out and he goes, you're an idiot. And I thought, I must be. It was devastating to me. And my girlfriend that night, she got one of those big red jugs of wine. And she goes, you know, what you need is a drink. And now people, you know, there comes that time, almost with everybody, I've heard so many stories, that there's nothing between you and that drink except God. And there's nothing between you and that drink except what it was like. Even though we have these forgetting tendencies. If we don't get that bottom that is sufficient, we're going to drink again. And I had that moment at that time in that hotel room with that girl who managed to do well on that bottle of wine. She got happy and then she got sleepy and she woke up the next day and she was fine. That wouldn't have been my story. And so I was able to, you know, think through the drink, as they say, and I could see that was not for me. And so I came. The next, either that night or the next morning, I can't remember, but it was immediate. I said to God, God, that's how I pray sometimes. It's like, God, I said, I'm sorry. I said, I've been hustling. I've been playing this game, even in sobriety. That's cheating. I said, I'll take the very next job I'm offered. Well, I got a call on Tuesday. Now we're going back to work in South Stockton. You know, that's close to Skid Row again. And I got an interview, and I went to work for this company who they didn't care if I wasn't a bookkeeper. They wanted a bookkeeper, but they didn't care if I was one, and they would train me. So they trained me. I made a whopping $7 an hour. It was the worst job I've ever had in my life. They obviously didn't know who I was, you know, and the place was surrounded by razor wire, and it was a carpentry place, and they made doors, and it was a sawmill, and they had a hardware store, and I worked in the office, and I would carry cash money in my hands back from the office to the front where the cash registers were. And, you know, it was a guy place, but I've been thoroughly trained that that's not for me. You know, I'm not allowed to go there. If I want friends, I need to call you or some other female, but not to have guy friends. And I was only there for a very short period of time. And pretty soon, I see this guy standing in front of me with a pitchfork. This goofy-looking guy. And I'm looking at him. I'm standing there holding a lot of money in my hand, so I'm thinking, well, this is kind of uncomfortable. And he says, pardon me, but this doesn't have a manual. Do you know how to work it? Now, is that corny? I know how to work a pitchfork. Excuse me? That was hilarious to me. And I thought, oh my gosh, that's so corny. And so, you know, he brought back a flyer the same hour. He came back with a trail riding group, and I was looking for one to join. And so that's how I met my husband. And God has a purpose, you know. He says to me, it doesn't matter if you know where we're going here. You just need to do it without a drink, and you need to trust, and you need to try to help another suffering alcoholic, and you need to be accountable, credible, and reliable to the best of your ability. And that's all I expect or hope for. And so he told me that summer, we went on a few rides together, and he was evidently dating somebody. And so I said, I'm done. I thought you were a single man. Well, evidently, she was moving out. You know the story. I didn't see him for another 6 months because I basically told him, you need to do what you need to do, and I don't want to be a part of it. 6 months later, he walks in, and he says, I'm single now. And I said, something snide, you know. And so we started that getting reacquainted thing, and it was a legitimate relationship. You know, I didn't have to move in like the day before I met him. And even though he said, you know, you could, even though he said you can quit your job. I mean, this job was a fabulous job, right? Not just anybody would give it up. It was really out there, and I was starving on the money, and I was living with my mom, and you know, I could have taken that advantage, and I didn't. And so for 3.5 years, I actually got to know the person, and I stayed at that job for 3.5 years. It was the worst job in the world, but see, God gave that job to me, and I treasured it. And so we got married and moved here, so it was like our honeymoon. So that's why my email address is honeymoonhollow@hotmail.com, because, you know, that's what we had going on here. And so, well, he thought of that, too. It was just amazing. So, you know, if you trust and don't need to know the outcome and have that personal, if I do this, not you, I meant to say that, if I do that, I'm going to be pleasantly surprised 99.999-tenths of the time. And the rest of it is really none of my business. I'm just supposed to be doing that trudge thing whenever necessary. Trudging means walking with a purpose. And today I have a single purpose, and that is to stay sober. And they told me in the group that I got sober in, we got good news and we got bad news. And the good news is you don't ever have to take a drink again. And the bad news is, look around, we're all your new friends, and you know how it is, how we feel like we're not with who we, you know, are people. And so, it's been a wonderful journey. It's been a wonderful opportunity to come here tonight. I've watched Billy and Sam do this thing for so many years. I've come to their functions, and it's just so cool to know that whether I'm in this position or that position, I'm still a part of it, you know. And I've learned how to be a part of things instead of apart from. Because when I was the one, it wasn't a very healthy environment for me. You know, I got way too much credit for way too little ability. And so that's the way of the world. The world will shine on you if you let it. But I don't believe that I could stay true to this program without a relationship with God and a relationship with people. I still, for the first time in 34 years, I got to call guys for a ride. Yay! So that was fun, and I appreciate that, and I appreciate this and you guys asking me, and so thank you very much.